Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Well, hi, friends. Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to our program. Today, we are joined by our general counsel, actually, here at Priests for Life, and Robert Muse from up in Michigan heads up the American Freedom Law Center, about which he will tell you a little bit, but we've been working together for many years. He helps many different pro-life leaders and organizations defend their constitutional rights in many different ways, but specifically in the protesting against abortion, in the saving of unborn children. Rob, thanks for all the work that you do, and good to be chatting with you today.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Father Pavone. You know, I couldn't do what I do without clients, without people who are willing to be out there in the public square, such as you and Priests for Life, whom I've represented several times in the past. So it's really a blessing to be able to do this work and to represent people like you who are fighting the good fight.
Well, you know, growing up, I never thought that I would end up being a petitioner at the United States Supreme Court. But working in partnership with you, we actually went all the way up to the Supreme Court, didn't we? Tell our viewers, just in a nutshell, what that was all about.
Right. That was the challenge to the so-called HHH mandate, the one that required Priests for Life and other religious organizations to provide contraceptive services, which included abortifacients as a matter of federal law. We challenged that all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. There were seven cases that were consolidated. We were, in fact, the second case. The Bishop Zuba case was the first case, or otherwise the case would have been Priests for Life versus the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And so it was a case we brought up. We got to go to the Supreme Court. The case was argued. All the adverse decisions, those decisions that were upholding this mandate, were vacated by that decision, meaning that they were nullified. And we subsequently entered into a very favorable agreement with the United States government that protected Priests for Life and other religious organizations from having to choose between harsh penalties, I mean severe penalties, or exercising your right to conscience, which is protected by the Free Exercise Clause. And in this case, protected by federal law, which is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So it was a great victory. Took many years to reach it, but it was certainly worth it.
You know, there's some aspects of this case that I want to explore with you for a moment or so. But before we do that, the American Freedom Law Center, tell our viewers about that if they're not familiar with it.
Right, we're a nonprofit public interest law firm. I co-founded the American Freedom Law Center nearly 8 years ago with my colleague David Urashami. David Urashami, as I like to say, he's the Orthodox Jew from New York. I am the Catholic here in Michigan with 12 children. So we like to describe ourselves as the nation's first truly authentic Judeo-Christian public interest law firm. So we defend the Judeo-Christian values of our nation and of believers. Pro-life causes are front and center in courtrooms all across the country. So we're national in scope, and as our last discussion just indicated, we take cases all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we've won many victories for free speech and for pro-lifers, and it's not a job, it's a vocation. I'm sure the same obviously for you with Priests for Life and all those who work for you and those in the pro-life movement. It's a calling, and it's a blessing to be able to use the gifts and talents that God has given me to defend religious liberty, the freedom of speech, free exercise of religion, and protect the right to life.
You know, we are talking to each other here, taping this interview during Constitution Week, and it's so appropriate that our nation has a particular day and week during the course of the year where we reflect very deliberately on the fact that we have a constitution. And of course, so many of these cultural battles do revolve around the question of how we read the Constitution, how the Constitution changes over the years, the legitimate ways that it changes, and ways that people like to make up out of thin air that they think it changes. Give us just again in a nutshell how important this is, that we have a constitution and that it has a fixed meaning which we are capable of understanding and which all of the branches of government are responsible to abide by.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the genius of our founding fathers, and I often think that the Holy Spirit was working, through them in creating this, constitutional republic, which is which we have. Because through the Constitution, not only the Bill of Rights, which I'll discuss in a moment, but we also have a system of government, a structure of government that was intended and designed to limit the power of government. We have three co-equal branches of government, and their duties and responsibilities are laid out in the Constitution. And all of that is put in place to ensure that we don't have a government with too much power. Because our founding fathers understood that there's sort of a inverse relationship between how the government grows. The more the government grows, the less freedoms and liberty that we have. And then to ensure that not only structurally did we protect we the people with our liberty and our freedom, they put in place the Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And the Bill of Rights, contrary to what people think, they're not rights that the government confers upon us, right? The Bill of Rights is a break on the power of government so that they don't infringe upon rights that we have that are God-given rights, right? And that first amendment that the founding fathers put in place was the right to freedom of speech and the right to free exercise of religion. And again, that's not the government conferring this right. The government can't confer upon rights. All they can do is fringe upon them. And the Bill of Rights provides us a measure of protection from that. And there is no other country in the world or in the history of humankind that has protected liberty like the United States and the United States Constitution. And from that, we flourished as a nation. So it's real important. You know, when you hear the Democrats principally arguing, for example, like to get rid of the Electoral College, again was a way that our founding fathers intended that power was going to be diffused, that you wouldn't have just these population centers like New York City or Chicago or Los Angeles, making decisions for the entire nation, right? Because you could still have a tyranny of the majority in that sense. So we don't have a pure democracy. So everybody says, well, my vote didn't necessarily count. Well, we don't have a pure democracy. We have a constitutional republic. And the whole purpose of that, again, is to protect liberty and to prevent tyranny. And everything that our founding fathers put in place was designed to do that. And it really was genius how they created it. And we have to do everything we can to protect it, right? And you hear also from the liberals and mostly the Democrats, they have this notion that we have a living and breathing constitution. Well, if you have a living and breathing constitution that can change at the whims of whoever's the majority in the U.S. Supreme Court, then you don't have a constitution.
Right. You don't have
right.
One
then now you're right. Now we're being led by, a majority of unelected justices.
Right.
And for people to think that, we see the symbols of justice, blind justice and the scales of justice. Well, if it was so blind, then why, what happened during these Kavanaugh hearings, what they did to Judge Bork? And the reality is, all of this is about Roe versus Wade. Right. If there's one disastrous decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that had no founding in law whatsoever, certainly not in the text of the U.S. Constitution, it was Roe versus Wade. And Roe versus Wade has now become the litmus test, not only for Supreme Court justices, but for justices all the way along the line, down at the other levels of at the district court level and the Court of Appeals. And so what it has in effect, it has corrupted our entire justice system. And so it's real important that we, keep moving towards getting that wrong precedent corrected.
Well, friends, those of you that are just joining us, we're talking with Robert Muse, who is from the American Freedom Law Center and also serves together with his partner, David Yerushalmi, as our general counsel here at Priests for Life. We are talking about the Constitution, about abortion, the right to life. Of course, Rob, the right to life is the first right that's indicated there in the Declaration of Independence. And in the Constitution, as you mentioned, the Bill of Rights, the freedoms that are mentioned begin with the freedom of religion. And this, of course, I want to kind of bring together for our audience these important concepts of religion, abortion and the Constitution and the courts, because we see these battles unfolding where you know, on the one hand, we're declaring, you know, life is the fundamental right. Governments exist to protect the rights that God gives us. That's in fact in the Declaration. Life is the first one. Freedom of religion is there. And yet we find ourselves fighting battles where the government is trying to take away both that right to life and that right to religious freedom. It's like things turn completely on their head. How would you summarize for people what this battle is between the right of religion, the freedom of religion, the right to life, and the way that the courts and the government are handling this abortion problem?
Well, I mean, Father Pavone, it really at the end of the day, it's a spiritual battle. I mean, and it's a battle, a power struggle. We have a human court system, and with that is going to come all the human failings. And Roe versus Wade is one of those human failings. You know, I spoke this past weekend at one of the Day of Remembrances for the aborted children, and one of the questions, and it kind of goes, I think, a little bit to what you're asking me here, that I thought hard about, that kept coming back to me, is why do we have abortion? I mean, why is it that we have this? Right? You point out in our Declaration of Independence, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have in the First Amendment the right to free exercise of religion, the right to freedom of speech. You even have in, you know, older Supreme Court cases that made the point that, you know, death forecloses all rights. So if there is one paramount right, it's the right to life. Otherwise, you don't possess any of the other rights that are conferred that you have that the government cannot interfere with as a matter of our Constitution, our Bill of Rights. And really, the only way I can explain is that, you know, evil exists, Satan exists, sin exists, and this is, these are the shortcomings that we have by our human nature. And you know, it's even interesting. George Washington, right, our first president, in his farewell address, made the point that religion and morality are the indispensable supports to our political success. So when we lose a sense of religion and a sense of morality, and certainly I can't think of a precedent that goes more to the heart of that than one that would permit the intentional killing of innocent human life, then this whole democratic process starts to unravel, and we see it. I think abortion is the result of sin. I've heard once, you know, told that, you know, Satan's greatest triumph in our time was to convince people that he doesn't exist. And I would say, as a lawyer, you know, exhibit number one is to the existence of evil is the fact that we allow abortion as a matter of constitutional law. So I be honest with you, I can't explain Roe versus Wade in any solid legal grounding because it doesn't exist. It's a matter of power, and it's a matter of evil existing in our culture and the failings of humans and our human court system. And, you know, this battle is, you know, we hope to win this battle in the legislative halls and the courtrooms, but where it's ultimately going to be successful is in our churches, and particularly our domestic churches and our families. We got to change the hearts and minds. That's why, you know, certainly what we do as a law firm in fighting these legal battles is essential. But I would say what's more essential is like what Priest for Life does when you're out there changing the hearts and minds. Because regardless of what the Supreme Court might say, if we had, you know, 100% of the people's hearts and minds were changed that they would never even think about going to get an abortion, there would be no need to have abortion. Roe versus Wade would be a meaningless, you know, precedent on a piece of paper. So we have to change hearts and minds. And when you change the hearts and minds, it's amazing how public policy will then typically follow, which goes back to the point why I spend so much time defending the right to freedom of speech. Because the right to freedom of speech is not just the right to catharsis. It's the right so people like you and other pro-lifers can be out there, can influence the, you know, public opinion so that we can shape public policy in ways that that are in accord with God's law and morality, that religion and morality, that the indispensable supports to our political success. So it's all tied in and wrapped up in that way is how I put it.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life, and we're talking with Robert Muse of the American Freedom Law Center. We work closely together defending freedom, defending life all over the country. Rob, let me ask you this question. Many people say, those who defend abortion or those that are just having a discussion about it, well, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. And they'll call it settled law. It's like, you know, they're trying to say, don't even argue about this or try to change this because this has already been settled. The issue has been decided. People will use the word precedent. The court has decided and reaffirmed it many times. From the legal perspective, none of that means that it's dogma, right? It's not unchangeable dogma. Make these the distinction there for people.
Right. Well, and certainly it's binding precedent on everybody but the U.S. Supreme Court, in a sense, because the court that can change that precedent, and the Supreme Court has done it in the past, Dred Scott, for example, right? That was the famous or infamous case that that held that a black man or black woman was not a person under the Constitution. Sounds very similar to Roe versus Wade, which was the ultimate holding that the unborn is not a person, therefore not afforded any of these protections under the Constitution. In Dred Scott, the Supreme Court held that a black person was not a person as a matter of law, and therefore didn't have the protections. And you know that's because Roe versus Wade is grounded in sand. Really, there's no foundation, for it. That's why the people that are the pro-abortion side, they're frightened. I mean, that's why this whole Kavanaugh battle and all these other battles of these justices, because they know that case does not have lasting effect if you're going to look at it from a legal perspective, and that it could be and should be overturned. You know, it's interesting. Justice Thomas, and I just want to read to you, because I pulled this up from a prior discussion you and I had. About the views of Justice Thomas. He's obviously, he conveys certainly the sentiment that he's very, very pro-life, understands that Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided and has said so in the past. And there was a case this year, 2019, which was Timms versus Indiana. And there the court unanimously held that the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause was incorporated by the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, were restrictions on the federal government. The 14th Amendment and most of those protections, like freedom of speech, free exercise, religion, so forth, have been incorporated as applying against the states through the 14th Amendment. So the question that came up to the court now is whether or not the excessive fines clause of the 8th Amendment should likewise be incorporated into the 14th Amendment as applied against the states. It had to deal with the case had to deal with the civil forfeiture issue. And all the justices agree that it should have been incorporated. Well, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas concurred, but they believe that it shouldn't have come through the due process doctrine of the 14th Amendment, but through the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Now, I just want to read for a moment, if I could, this Justice Thomas's concurrence. And he says, because the oxymoronic substantive due process doctrine has no basis in the Constitution, it is unsurprising that the court has been unable to adhere to any guiding principle to distinguish fundamental rights that warrant protection from non-fundamental rights that do not. And because the court's substantive due process precedent allows the court to fashion fundamental rights without any textual constraints, it is equally unsurprising that among these precedents are some of the court's most notoriously incorrect decisions. And he cites, see, for example, Roe versus Wade and Dred Scott versus Sanford.
Wow!
So that was a powerful concurrence, and again, as you and I have discussed previously, I don't think he was just writing for the masses. I think he was writing for the other justices on the bench,
yes,
and just reminding him, the Dred Scott decision was overturned, was overruled, and there are other cases that were so incorrectly decided that they call out for a reversal. Justice calls out for their reversal. And Justice Thomas was making the point here that, you know, along with Dred Scott, in that category is also Roe versus Wade.
Well, he has made a number of powerful statements in recent months. I know that in another opinion, he reminded everyone, the Constitution itself is silent on abortion. Nobody can say there's a right to abortion in the Constitution. It says nothing about it. And he also pointed out that if the court decides something wrongly at a particular point in time, the fact that a lot of time goes by with that decision in place, or even the fact that the court may, in fact, reaffirm that decision multiple times, neither the passage of time nor the multiple reaffirmations turn a wrong decision into a right one. And this is where it seems to me he's signaling to us all, you know, don't think that just because Roe v. Wade has been around since 1973 that it can't be changed by this court.
Right. And like I said, I think that's exactly, you know, exactly true. And, you know, we got to get the right justices up there.
Yes.
And, you know, the thing that's it's interesting, and I wish Republicans had done a good as job as the Democrats have done whenever they get a Democratic president elects a Supreme Court justice, there's never any doubt what position they're going to have on this fundamental issue. But I don't know why it is a Republicans. It always seems to either, you know, we have these stealth justices, or we don't fully understand what their particular views are on this. And the fact remains is it's not a question per se of, you know, whether you're pro-life or hold a particular religious view. It's a question of, you know, how do you apply the Constitution?
Right.
This goes to fundamental, and that's Justice Thomas's point that you were just highlighting. It's not, he might be pro-life and might be a Catholic and understand that, you know, abortion is an intrinsic evil. But even as a Supreme Court justice, looking at how they had to torture the Constitution and create these fundamental rights when there's no textual grounding for them, that undermines the entire Constitution by doing that. So even if you want to leave religion out of this, even if you want to leave political views out of this, we want justices on the Supreme Court who are going to adhere to the constitutional principles that our country was founded upon. That's the only way we can protect liberty. And if you had a justice that did that, they would overrule Roe versus Wade, because it undermines those very principles that our Constitution was founded upon.
And this is exactly the way it's supposed to work. It's supposed to have nothing to do with the justice's personal views on the issue being decided, but rather, what does the Constitution and the statutory law that might apply in that case have to say about the matter, right? And that kind of objectivity is really, I mean, that's gold. I mean, that's what we're trying to look for in these jurists.
Right. And, you know, and I think President Trump has done a remarkable job at I'm not 100% in on Justice Kavanaugh. Certainly he's way better than anything that a President Hillary Clinton would have put on the bench. But, you know, he's filling a lot of slots down at the district court level and the court of appeals level. And hopefully we're going to start seeing some sane decisions coming out of those courts here in the future. Those, you know, that's the part of the presidency that a lot of people, I think, tend to overlook, is that the role they have in putting judges and justices in the federal court system has a lasting effect well beyond that president's time in office. You know, we certainly saw what Obama did to the court system, and Trump is working diligently to change that. And I haven't seen the numbers, but I understand that he's appointing more than anybody to the benches, and he's got some very good people who are vetting those potential judges to ensure that we have those sitting, you know, whether at the district court level or the appellate court level, that understand what their role is as a judge, and it's not to make the law as you go, or to promote your own personal political, interests, but to adhere to constitutional principles. And the more we can do that, the more every American is going to be protected by our Constitution.
Well, friends, if you're just joining us, I am Father Frank Pavone, National Director of Priests for Life, and we're welcoming to our program today Robert Muse of the American Freedom Law Center. And I wanted to ask you, Rob, about something that you were sharing with me recently. You know, the moves that have been made from the beginning of 2019 in certain states to expand access to abortion even beyond the extreme place that it was already, places like New York and other states, has been really disturbing to a lot of people, and it has reignited the abortion debate. It's gotten it to a boiling point, it seems to me. Other states, of course, have become more bold to protect the unborn earlier and earlier in pregnancy. But how do you see this effort unfolding and how we can fight back against it when states will say absolutely no restrictions whatsoever will apply to abortion? You could do it up until birth, and they're even taking protection away from babies born alive after a failed abortion.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I think this is the this is diabolical, and the more that you can shed light on evil, the more we can, you know, they expose themselves as to what they are. Right, you look at the findings in that abortionist in South Bend with the over 2,000, aborted babies, human remains that were found. The more we can expose that evil, I think the more that people will realize what it truly is.
Yes.
And I think it's a mistake. I think they're stepping out into the light. I think there's a boldness, but the boldness is grounded in pride, right? That was Satan's original, failing. The ultimate of the sins was this pride, right? Pride goes before the fall. And the more they expose themselves, I think the more that people are realizing what the truth of what abortion is,
yes.
Right? They want to hide it behind this veil. They always want, hide it behind terms like choice and woman's rights and, it's my body and, different, but it's always hidden. And that's why I know you're an advocate for, and I've certainly had several cases. In fact, we just won one in California where I defend the right to show graphic images of abortion because abortion is graphic.
Yes.
Right? These images convey a truth that can't be conveyed any other way, that words cannot express. And so it's no surprise that those who support abortion want to hide those images, who want to keep it still behind that veil, behind that dark cloud. So the more we can expose it, I think the better it is, because we can show the evil. And then the more prideful they could become, and the more that they step out into the light, I think it's going to inure to our benefit ultimately. And I think they've made huge, not just tactical, but strategic mistakes in the way that, the way New York in particular, came out with this. I think people who might otherwise be sitting on the sidelines or kind of lukewarm on the abortion industry, they look at this and they say, what, you can kill a baby after it's born? I mean, that's shocking to them. And it's going to, I think, mobilize people who otherwise wouldn't be, who otherwise might be lukewarm. So, the more we can expose the evil of abortion, I think the better off we are.
And do you foresee legal backlash here? Are there ways to fight legally against these expansions of abortion law?
No, I think there are. I think there's certainly precedent already where the Supreme Court upheld the ban on partial birth abortion. You know, what New York did is very interesting because essentially what they did is they said that, the unborn and even there's virtually zero protections for them under the law. And, what's interesting, there was a case that went up to the Supreme Court in the 1990s that came out of Colorado when a lot of these local laws were being passed that provided special rights and privileges based on sexual orientation. Well, the citizens in Colorado passed a constitutional referendum where it would essentially set as a matter of state constitution that you can't provide any of these special rights, any of these special privileges, even though sexual orientation is not a suspect classification, doesn't have any particular high level of protection under the Constitution, went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, look, you can't just as a matter of law carve out, an exception for an entire class of people, even though that the issue that they were carving out wasn't particularly protected under the Equal Protection Clause. I don't see why a similar argument couldn't be made with what's happening in New York. Because granted, abortion is protected under the Roe versus Wade precedent, but certainly most states have laws. For example, if a woman is pregnant and she got run down by a reckless truck driver, you could have a wrongful death action on two counts. The unborn child is recognized under the law in certain circumstances, mostly outside of the abortion context, as having a a particular right, right? Which shows how bizarre, you know, Roe versus Wade is. You could have a pregnant woman who was shot and killed, and it's a double homicide, the baby and her, or the woman that I said was, you know, who was maybe walking across the street, run down by a reckless truck driver. You know, there could be a wrongful death action or even a, you know, negligent homicide on two counts. But yet if she was walking across the street to an abortion center and, you know, an abortionist, you know, killed the baby, then it's, you know, somehow a constitutional right. But the point being, I think with the way New York has gone so far, I think there might be some susceptibility there to an equal protection challenge, to the fact that they're carving out an exception that this unborn human life is going to be non-recognized and, in fact, have zero protections under the law, and that goes beyond the the abortion context. So I think there's something there. I'm gonna keep scratching at that surface and see what we can come up with. But I think there might be some concerns there for issues with that New York law.
Yeah, well, it's certainly waking a lot of people up, and we look forward to continuing that conversation and checking in with you as these arguments continue to develop in the legal sphere. Well, we're out of time for this broadcast, but friends, we've been having discussions that touch on so many things that you ask about and that you are working on in your local communities. So we encourage you to continue to be in contact with us as you continue to speak up and act for the right to life. And Rob, how can they contact the American Freedom Law Center?
Well, the best place to go is our website, AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org. Check out our Facebook page. We constantly keep people updated on what's going on. And I think they'll find some interesting information at either one of those on our website or our Facebook page.
Well, you're always arguing a lot of cases and preparing a lot of legal documents, and they all shed light and encouragement on the very pro-life work and the free speech rights that our audience is trying to exercise each day. So that's why I know that they will find your resources of great value, and we'll certainly look forward to having you on again in future episodes. Thank you, Robert Muse, American Freedom Law Center.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.